Well, thank you so much, Dana. And thank you to HSU, because for me, this is like really where I get my battery charged. I mean, I feel like I'm here for political therapy tonight. I don't know about you. And, you know, that therapy means just standing up and throwing off this propaganda that's intended to make us feel disempowered, that's intended to make us feel hopeless and powerless. And it's not true. And I'm going to tell you why I think it's not true, and why it's just around the corner. You know, I feel like I'm playing one of those video games where you think you're just about to win, and you keep playing and you keep playing. And for me, it's gone on for many years. But there was a time when many of us were playing this game and we were doing it alone, and we were really voices in the wilderness, and we were told that we were the lunatic fringe, and we were basically all on our own. And for me, you know, I started off as an activist, as a healthcare provider, but a healthcare provider seeing like this epidemic of asthma and cancer and diabetes and all these new problems that we didn't used to have. And I said, hey, our genes didn't change overnight. There are things going on around us in our environment. So I sort of got radicalized as a healthcare provider and started fighting those battles. Worked with various organizations, but we always felt like we were the lunatic fringe, because people were always saying, you know, no, that's ridiculous. No, we don't need to clean up our power plants. We don't need to stop the incinerators. You know, it's just, this is the way things are. Anyhow, I got tricked into running for office back in 2002 by the Green Party. I had never been a political person and had never gone to a political meeting, never been a part of any partisan anything, because it was all so corrupt and manipulative. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then basically the Green Party said, well, why don't you keep doing what you're doing as an activist? And I was part of community efforts to shut down incinerators and coal plants and clean up toxic waste sites, and said, well, just, you know, keep doing that. You'll have a bigger audience. And, you know, so I thought, well, you know, everything else is failing. Might as well try electoral politics, you know, sort of like as a last resort. And what I discovered, you know, because anybody out there run for office? I know there are a few people there. All right. And big shout out, by the way, to those people, the Greens especially, who have made such a difference in Arcata and in Humboldt County. Can we just give a big thank you? And that shout out, of course, goes to HSU as well for doing the amazing things that you are doing. Water defenders and forest defenders and all that. So anyhow, I was tricked into running for office because, you know, I was like, why not try that, you know? And to make a long story short, I found that when you get out there and you're running for office, you're sort of like public property, and you talk to anybody anytime when they want to talk to you. You talk. And I discovered that there was so much hunger out there for human beings who were running for office, as opposed to these robots who just like had their corporate agenda and their talking points and all that. And so I was like, I entered that race out of desperation, but I emerged with inspiration. And in the course of that race, we fought our way into a televised debate. Because even back in 2002, people were tearing their hair out just listening to the Democrat and the Republican really just argue about who's the bigger corporate crook. And that's really what they were arguing about back then. And I gave voice to the usual Green Party agenda at that time, which was greening our energy. It was teaching to the whole student for lifetime learning, not to a high stakes test. It was demilitarizing our foreign policy and putting our dollars into real security here at home. It was healthcare as a human right for everyone. At the time we called it single payer. And inside of the debate hall, it was just a TV studio. Those ideas went over like a lead balloon. But when I walked out, thinking, you know, that that was a miserable failure, walked out to where the press was waiting, and I got mobbed by the press for the first time and the last time. And they told me, they have since been otherwise instructed, you know, now I'm an enemy of the state, you know, as we all are. We all have the great distinction and honor of being that enemy of the state. And they said that I had won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And who knew that there was an instant online viewer poll going on? And you can be sure that was the last time they did an instant online viewer poll during a debate, because they don't like these results to be a public knowledge, which was that this was, back then as it is now, a majoritarian agenda. This is where most people are. This is why Bernie Sanders would have beat Donald Trump hands down, had the DNC not sabotaged him. So, you know, that's basically my first point, and kind of my last point, too, which is that we really do have the power. We're just told a million times a day that we are powerless, you know, and so we should be hopeless, and therefore we should be, you know, we should all just, like, go home and lie down on the railroad tracks, you know, as far as they're concerned. And they do that because they know that, in fact, we do have the power, which is why they keep us from getting to the political microphone. In this last race, 76% of people, according to polls, were screaming to open up the debates. We deserve open debates, not run by the political parties of the corporations. If we had those debates, you can be sure that the outcome of the election would be very different. And, you know, we are fighting this in court now with some success, and we'll see where it goes. But, you know, whether we fight this in court or we fight it out in the streets or in the court of public opinion, you know, this is part of reclaiming our democracy. And had we been able to do that, we would have very different results in that election and in this election. And in elections going forward, people have had it up to here with this very corrupt and rotten political system. And we've just come out of this election, which was a very toxic and corrupt election. It's no surprise that it had such a toxic and corrupt result. It was more, you know, it was more degraded by money and corporate media than ever before. Donald Trump had something like, I don't know what it was, $4 billion worth of free media. And the president of CBS actually stated explicitly, Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he sure is good for CBS. So that's what we've gotten, you know? We've gotten a president and a political establishment now, which is terrible for the American people, but it's great for the corporate media. So, you know, this is part of that problem which we need to solve. But the exciting thing is that there is a solution underway. I used to think that we had to change people's minds, and I spent, you know, the first 50 years of my life trying to change people's minds. And then I got into that debate, and I realized people's minds, surprise, surprise, have been changed by the economy, by the climate, by our healthcare system, by predatory student loan debt. People have been put through the ringer, and now we don't have to change their minds anymore. All we have to do is get organized to harness the power that we actually have. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We have it, and we're going to use it. Get ready. So I don't know if happy is the right word, but maybe it's struggle. Congratulations on the struggle. International Women's Day. Thanks to everyone for being a part of it, recognizing it, supporting it. That's today, and people around the world in 50 countries began to explore this tool called the general strike. Keep that in mind, because it's not going away. I think it's just beginning to come back. And I think it's a really important sign that that women's march, which was just a march, completely without an agenda, back on the day after inauguration, January 21st. It was just a march, but then they decided to do it again, and this time call a strike. So this is definitely a move in the right direction, and where we really need to go. And to their credit, this day of disengagement, this day of boycotting participation, this day of massive non-participation, which is what they called for, it was not only to support women's reproductive rights, it was also for women's economic rights and health rights and social rights. So it was, you know, it was the beginnings of a much more unified and inclusive kind of action. Ideally, we want to go to a place where we're bringing together people from across the spectrum. And for us as Greens, the motto these days is people, planet, and peace over profit. That's what we need to really achieve true systemic change. And when we're bringing together people from all of those sectors, from all the areas of social justice and economic justice and LGBTQ justice and for laborers and women and indigenous justice and for the communities of color and for immigrants, and we're putting that together with climate justice and environmental justice, and also calling for peace, because we must have peace if we're going to solve all the other problems. You know, it's like you don't go to your doctor and say, would you just take care of my left kidney and forget about the rest of me? You know, we are whole people. We live in a whole world. We need all of these things, and we should not be intimidated into thinking that we have to settle for window dressing around the margins. We really need nothing less than an America and a world that works for all of us. If it doesn't work for all of us, it's really not going to work for any of us. A couple words about some of the things that might be on your mind. And by the way, you know, we'll have time to open this up for your thoughts and your questions so we can get right to it. So I'm just going to kind of lay the groundwork here. You know, this uprising that we're seeing now, of which the women's movement is just one example, you know, shout out for all the pipeline blockades going on right now. Shout out to Standing Rock in particular, to the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and to HSU for supporting that effort as well. Likewise, for the fight, sure, yeah, thank you, that would be great. The fight for healthcare as a human right. There are so many, you know, the fight to defend the rights of immigrants and to stop the deportations, which are cruel and arbitrary and counterproductive, doesn't, you know, begin to capture it. You know, absolutely wrongheaded and destructive, creating the very, resentment that positions us in a place of great vulnerability. There are statistics out there showing that, in fact, not a single refugee actually from any country. Not a single refugee has been responsible for killing any Americans since the Refugee Act was passed in something like 1980. So, you know, this is just absolute nonsense. And from the 6 targeted countries now, not a single immigrant either has been responsible for American deaths. So this is just fear-mongering, which is what we have come to expect from demagogues. So, you know, this is just, the agenda is absolutely absurd, and it's very important that we stand up to resist it. But this uprising that we're seeing is coming very much in response to a global assault on all dimensions of our lives. And I think, you know, you don't need to be reminded of that, you know, whether it's our economy, our ecology, peace, democracy, human rights, it's all under attack, a very serious attack. And it's not a new attack. It may be more vicious, it may be more explicit, it may be accelerating drastically under Donald Trump, but this is not new. We've seen this for decades under neoliberalism as well. And in many ways, neoliberalism paves the way to neo-fascism. And one of the ways that that happens, you know, people have been thrown under the bus. Neoliberalism is that sort of the unbridled free market. It's just sort of profit come hell or high water, you know, make the profit at whoever's expense. And that meant financializing the economy. It meant offshoring our jobs. It meant the global trade agreements. It meant austerity, depriving everyday people of the basic support that they need. That program has thrown people under the bus. You know, this year, Oxfam came out with the data that 8 billionaires have the wealth of one half of the world's population is held by just these 8 people. Is that a familiar statistic to people? Some of you have heard that. I mean, it's just staggering. But what's even more staggering is that the year before, it was 65 billionaires. Now it's just 8. What does that tell you? You know, we're absolutely going in the wrong direction. All of the indicators tell us that. So people are being broadly thrown under the bus. And we've seen that in this country where average wages now are just barely above the poverty level, where there is, you know, an entire generation of young people locked into predatory student loan debt. Black lives are on the firing line, immigrants facing mass deportation. You know, this is not working, and this is the product of neoliberalism. What happened then in the last couple of months, really, was that we had this flip from neoliberalism to kind of neo-fascism. And the difference in neo-fascism is that you no longer have a commitment to democracy. You no longer give lip service to the ideals of democracy or to human rights. It becomes a much more authoritarian kind of culture, much more trending towards totalitarianism, much more prone to violence, and actually elevating this kind of ethic of violence and militarism. And what history tells us is that societies flip and they become neo-fascist when people are just beat up and beat up and beat up, and they become hopeless and they become angry, and then you get this flip into neo-fascism. That's why neoliberalism paves the way to neo-fascism. They're both very dangerous. One leads to the other, and it's really important that we stand up. And the only way to fix it, as Bernie Sanders himself used to say over and over, the only way to fix this is with a truly radical progressive agenda that ensures that everyone's needs are met. Working people, immigrants, people of color, the middle class, which is rapidly, you know, heading towards the impoverished class. People do crazy things when they feel really embattled. That's where people are right now. And we don't need to be that way. We do not have a scarcity of resources. Those resources are being hoarded by the 1%. We need to open that back up and ensure that everyone has the resources that they need. That includes the right to a good wage job. Not only the right to good wages, but the right to a job as well with good wages. As well as health care as a human right, education as a human right, including through college. College education should be a human right and a public good. We should be bailing out the students locked and the graduates locked into student debt like we did for the crooks on Wall Street. And when people say to you, well, how can we possibly afford to do that? That's $1.3 trillion. Here's one answer that I suggest you give them. Right now, we have dedicated $1 trillion to creating a new generation of nuclear weapons. How about instead of creating a new generation of nuclear weapons, instead we create a new generation of secure young people by getting them out of debt instead of creating the weapons that could just kill us all? So, you know, these are very dangerous ideas because people support them and because they make so much common sense. So the name of the game is getting the word out. We don't have to change people's minds. All we have to do is organize. And as horrible as these times are now, you know, no one would have wished them on us. But the silver lining is that they have really forced us to mobilize. And remember, as we are mobilizing, that Donald Trump is in a very vulnerable position. I mean, he may talk like he's quite the power broker, but remember, this is a guy who has 500 businesses, which are essentially a landmine of vulnerability for him, for conflicts of interest, for legal liabilities, for legal cases against him for either participating in bribery or for taking bribery because of the relationship of his businesses to his dealings with other countries. He's refused to give them up. And also his constitutional violations because the Constitution, you know, has this so-called emoluments clause, which means that when you're in office, you cannot have investments, you cannot have business relationships with other countries. So he is really, there are many lawsuits against him already. We've seen his hands tied around his outrageous first immigration policy, now on his outrageous second immigration policy. He's been forced to have his national intelligence director, Michael Flynn, thank you. He had to resign. You know, Jeff Sessions could be in a lot of hot water. So, you know, Donald Trump is not sitting pretty. Remember, there was a guy named Richard Nixon. And you may remember what happened to him. But even before he got impeached, what did we achieve under Richard Nixon? I don't know if there are many people out there who remember. It may have been before your time, but we achieved an awful lot. We brought the troops home from Vietnam. We got women's right to choose from a conservative Supreme Court. We enacted the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the EPA and OSHA to defend workers' health and safety, all under this very corrupt, tyrannical, authoritarian president, one of the worst in history. And we did that because we knew our lives were on the line. Our brothers, largely, were being sent to die in Vietnam, particularly our brothers of color. And so people got out there knowing that their lives really depended on what we did out in the streets. Well, I think history has kind of come full circle right now because we know that our lives depend on changing our direction right now, whether you look at the climate crisis, whether you look at the economy, which is in essentially a slow downward spiral in which a generation is trapped in debt, in which people are living hand to mouth, it might be like a third or 50%, something like that. It's a huge number of people who don't have access to like even $500 excuse me, worth of savings to be able to pay for an emergency hospital visit. You know, we're facing expanding wars right now. You know, there and are we winning these wars? You know, we are not winning these wars. These wars have created, you know, failed states and mass refugee migrations and worse terrorist threats, even though they are costing us trillions of dollars. You know, how can they get away with even pretending that this is an effective policy that you would want to expand? This is a policy we should be retreating from as fast as we possibly can. And yet they keep trying to use this to, you know, create more failed states and more refugees. It's like they can only do this because they keep us away from the microphone. They keep us away from standing up and telling the truth that people recognize when they have a chance to hear it. So the bottom line, you know, is that this is about standing up and organizing. And that means organizing in our movements. It means organizing for women's rights, for protecting the climate, for our water supplies, for stopping the pipelines, for stopping all new fossil fuel infrastructure. We should not be building a single new piece of fossil fuel infrastructure. We should be in the process of dismantling them rapidly. And let me just expand on that for a moment. When Pearl Harbor was bombed at the outset of the Second World War, people didn't say, oh, let's take three or four decades, you know, to respond to this national emergency. It took 6 months to transform the economy to be a full-powered war economy. Unfortunately, we have never retreated from that war economy. And that economy is not sustainable. Almost half of your income taxes is going to pay for this bloated military. It's going to pay for 54%, I think it is, of our discretionary budget is going to this military, which is not making us safer. It is making us arguably less secure, not more secure, and it's depriving us of what we need here at home. So we should be putting that money where we need it. These are the kinds of things that people get and people understand. And it's outrageous that the Trump administration is now proposing an additional 9% increase in our military budget. We should be slashing our military budget in half and putting that money into our true needs here at home. And I'll say just a quick word about the solution here, kind of an overarching solution that solves so many of these problems. We need that emergency program, like the mobilization for the Second World War. We need a wartime scale mobilization to meet the climate crisis now. That means an emergency jobs program to transform our energy, our food, our public transportation, and to restore our ecosystems at a minimum. And to do that in a time frame to achieve 100% clean renewable energy by 2030, if not sooner. That's the kind of solution that we need to fix this. And it is a jobs program. It is an emergency jobs program. That's how you get past this roadblock that we're constantly thrown up against. We're told, no, people won't support that because they want jobs. Well, it's not like one or the other. You can only do this. We're only going to get out of here alive by doing both. We need an economic revival at the same time that we need to save our climate. And the Green New Deal will do that. It calls for an emergency 20 million jobs at living wages that essentially guarantees a good job for everyone who wants a job that will make you healthy, that will make your community healthy, that will protect our climate and future generations, instead of these fossil fuel jobs, which make people sick. Your risk of dying goes up 700% when you walk into a fossil fuel job. And the workers know that. And they argue for these jobs and they argue against green energy only because they don't have the green energy jobs. But in fact, solar created more jobs last year than oil, coal, and gas all put together. So we should be moving with all due speed to solar and wind right now. To do so would revive the economy, turn the tide on climate change, and make the friggin' wars for oil obsolete. All in one swell swoop. And the last thing about that is that it also pays for itself. How does it do that? In health benefits alone. We get so much healthier by eliminating fossil fuel pollution that the savings in sick care are enough to pay back the costs of the green energy transition. This has been established in study after study. It was also shown in Cuba, you know, when their oil pipeline went down during that period when the Soviet Union collapsed, basically, and they didn't have any oil, and they had to convert to green energy, a healthy, organic, local food system, and muscle-powered transportation. You know, you would have thought their economy's crashing, their health would have gone down the tubes. But what actually happened? Their death rate from diabetes went down 50%. Their death rate from heart attacks and strokes went down 30%. All-cause mortality went down 20%. And what did it cost them? Zero. We're spending, you know how much? Over $3 trillion a year. Not on a healthcare system, on a sick care system that doesn't make up for how sick the fossil fuels and the sick food and our sick transportation and just plain old social stress is making us. Just by getting rid of the dirty energy and converting to a healthy food and transportation system, including, by the way, safe sidewalks and bike paths that dovetail with public transportation, you know, that's how you get people out. And you shouldn't have to join a health club and spend $1,000 in order to get your exercise. It should be integrated into what we're doing. So we can fix this. It pays for itself. It feels good. It is good. And people are hungry for it. In fact, are literally dying for it. And we can fix this. When people ask me what kind of medicine I'm practicing, I say, now I'm practicing political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses. And if we want to fix the things that are literally killing us, all we got to do is fix this sick political system, because these things will fix themselves if we just reclaim the promise of a democracy. We've never really had a democracy, but now we really, really don't have a democracy. And we need to actually claim that democracy. When we do that, we can actually start to solve these things. And that includes, you know, standing up, standing together, out there, acting with the social movements, but also, in addition to the social movements, it means fighting the political fight. Politics, as I finally came to realize after 50 years of refusing to deal with it, politics is essentially coalition building. And if you want to build a coalition and you want it to stay together for more than like one bill, if you only build a coalition for a bill, guess what? When your coalition goes away, they're going to repeal the bill. So, you know, you have to stay on it. We discovered this in Massachusetts when we passed campaign finance reform. We got big money out of politics by creating public financing for qualified candidates. We created a big coalition to do that. And guess what? After we passed it, the Democratic legislature, in all of its wisdom, repealed it on a voice vote in the back room in a Democratic caucus. They put an end to it, which is where I realized my future was not going to be with the Democratic Party. So it is about building that coalition, and that coalition is political. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We need to be that demand. We need to be organized in order to have that demand. And that means standing up against these political parties that are both funded by predatory banks, by fossil fuel giants, by war profiteers. The sabotage that the DNC did against Bernie Sanders, they did against Dennis Kucinich before him, they did against Jesse Jackson. You can go back to the 1960s when they stopped the realignment movement, which was an effort back in the 1960s to clean up and retrieve the Democratic Party and make it a people's party. They've been stopping it for decades, and the DNC just stopped it again. What, 2 weeks ago, when they rejected the reform candidates and every reform proposition put before them. So if you had any doubts, let those doubts be erased. It's time to Dem exit and Green enter. And I want to give a shout out because I know there are tables back there or people with clipboards. So if you haven't actually broken up from that abusive political relationship, tonight's a good night to break up with that abusive relationship on International Women's Day. Let's honor healthy relationships and have a healthy political relationship. Get involved with your Green Party. I don't know if there is a Campus Greens. Yes, all right. Raise your hand, Campus Greens. All right, thank you so much. So see that man over there. Because it's so, you know, no pressure, but it's always the younger generation that truly creates transformative change. That's just always been the case. And I'm sorry to have to break that news to you if you didn't know it. But that's just the hard truth, because by the time your hair gets to be my color, many people are seeing the world the way it's been over the many decades, and they're not seeing the world the way it is today. That's why effective change always has to be organized by the people who are actually living it. And no one is living it more than the younger generation who has been the latest victim of this predatory economy, which is destroying not only the economy, but the very basis for life itself, destroying our environment and our water and our climate and our ecosystems. I don't know if you heard the news last week. There was an article in the academic journal Geology about the meltdown of the permafrost. Have people heard about this yet? So it is accelerating massively right now. This study showed that like 10% of the landmass in northwestern Canada now shows evidence of massive permafrost melt. And that's not a good thing. That says to me, it's time. In fact, we're out of time. You know, there is no reason to hold back now. There's nothing to hold back for. We really need to start mobilizing. A couple years ago, Jim Hansen did a study that said, it concluded that we could see 10, 20 feet of sea level rise as soon as 2060. It's not that far away. How many people in this room plan to be here around 2060? I dare say most people in this room. So, if you wanna, now, that was before we had this new data about methane. right? Because as far as I've been able to tell, that study and all the other studies didn't include the impact of permafrost melt because nobody knew when it was going to really happen. So we could be looking at things accelerating a whole lot more than 2060. We could be looking at massive sea level melt before then. So we really, really need that emergency Green New Deal now. And maybe instead of 2030, you know, maybe we need to ban all fossil fuels much sooner than that. Because there is no downside to doing this. It just means we get healthier sooner, we get employed sooner, we stop the fights over fossil fuels. In fact, this could be the solution to a global world conflict as well, because right now we are burning fossil fuels so that we can fight over fossil fuels. Well, how about instead we all just put our military dollars into converting our energy systems to green energy systems so we don't have to fight in the first place? How about them apples? So this is something that we can do. When it comes down to brass tacks, this is about registering green. It's about running green. It's about starting new chapters. It's about the power to the people agenda. It's about living wages. It's about sanctuary cities. And I have to give a shout out to Arcata and to the city councilors. Raise your hand if you're in the room and you're part of this. Big shout out. Yes, thank you. Thank you for creating that sanctuary city whose time has come, and that's Paul Patino, right? Do I have it right? Thank you, Paul. I have to give a thank you also to Dave Meserve. Did I say that right? Meserve. I don't know if Dave is in the room tonight, but shout out wherever you are, Dave, for standing up against the Patriot Act and creating a binding resolution some years ago when the Patriot Act was first launched to stand up for our right to privacy and our right not to be subject to intrusive searches. And I think that that Arcata was the first and maybe the only city that actually passed a binding resolution to support privacy. And I imagine people have heard the latest news talk about intrusions on privacy. People heard the latest news about the CIA? Well, you've got the CIA on your cell phone right now. So if you need to communicate anything to the CIA, they may be on your iPhone. They may be listening right now. So just for them to know, you do not have our permission. But unfortunately, that hasn't stopped them before. But it really puts this whole debate about who is spying on who and who is hacking who has a whole new wrinkle to it right now. Because not only does the CIA have this trove of tools for hacking, for cyber warfare, and for similar forms of tampering, but according to some sources, they also have the ability to use the hacking tools of other countries as a Trojan horse to cover their tracks. So it makes you wonder, if stuff is being blamed on the Russians, was it really the Russians? It makes it very hard to know, especially when your CIA director to start with went before Congress and promised that no one was being spied upon. It does make you wonder about other things that the CIA director goes on to say. So this is just more reason why politics of the people, why a government like the city council of Arcata is the kind of government that we all deserve, a government we can trust, a government that is not secretly working for the software companies, that's not secretly working for the prison industry or for the war predators and the war manufacturers or the nuclear weapons industry or the healthcare industry. We need a government that's of, by, and for the people, that's working for us. It's time to say no to the lesser evil, to stand up and fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because in fact they do. We can have an America and a world that works for all of us, that puts people, planet, and peace over profit. The power to create that world is not just in our hopes, it's not just in our dreams. Right here and now, more than ever, it's in our hands. Thank you so very much for making it so. Now it's your turn, and we have a microphone here. Yes. And if you'll come up to the mic, we can all hear you, and maybe just form a line. And I'm going to ask you to try to keep your question to, let's see, how many people we got? We got a few coming up. So try to keep your question to a minute if you can, so we can be sure that everybody gets in. And I will try to give you a lightning answer so we can be sure that everybody has time to be heard.
Thank you, Dr. Jill Stein. I'm Steve G. Davis. I've been blessed with a Master of Arts from my Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan. And I have an undergraduate degree from Business and Art from Pacific Union College, an interdisciplinary degree there. And I just want, first and foremost, what can Greens and Friends do for an all-out effort to stop illegal behavior, helping all people to get to a good, even a great, God-blessed quality of life? Mm-hmm. Now, churches and Native American lands have their own power, so that's a good thing. And I'm suggesting, because this was my master's research project, community focus groups to solve the people who need justice power opportunities to apologize for bad or even illegal behavior of the past, mm-hmm. do what they can to make amends, and nicely go where directed by authorities. And please, ICE be nice.
Beautiful. Thank you, Steve. Well said. I feel like I don't need to say very much. You made the case. I'll just add that it's been found. You know, doctors make mistakes, as we all know.
Unfortunately,
and hospital and medical errors account for like a huge number of deaths every year.
It's a chronic situation in California. You're waiting for hours, and the desperate health care professionals don't know what to do.
Yes.
And must be solved as soon as possible with more health care professionals, more places where people who just need a nice sleep, just to catch up with their homelessness, solving this is all together bound up in making sure we're all doing all we can for the great state of California. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
To make it legal and safe.
Thank you. Well said. Thank you. Well, let the next person come up. Yeah, and I'll just add, the point I was going to make there about physicians is that it's been found that when healthcare providers apologize, that it's actually, it really helps everybody move on, you know, instead of pretending that nothing happened. And I would say the same thing about reparations for slavery and for the seizing of indigenous lands. We need to develop reparations, make those reparations, and restore our society to wholeness. This is not just about doing right by those who've been deprived, you know, very cruelly and unjustly of their resources and their possessions. This makes us all better as a society. Thank you for your good point, Steve. Yes.
Hi, Jill. My name is Alec, and I'm a former student at HSU and also a community member. I wanted to thank you for coming to Arcata. I have actually three quick questions I'll ask. The first question I have is, you know, you're in Bernie country, so how can you convince us to spend our time with the Green Party as opposed to the Democratic Party, and can you distinguish yourself from Bernie Sanders specifically? My second question is, a lot of people discredit you for your stance on vaccinations. Can you please clarify that for us for the record? And then my third question is, what as individuals can we do to address climate change most effectively, in your opinion?
Great. Okay, terrific questions. You know, Greens versus Burners. Let me just say, there are lots of burners who are burning green.
I voted for you, by the way.
I was working for you, okay. By the way. you know, I feel like the important thing here is not to close your eyes to what history is telling us. And what just happened to Bernie, happened to Dennis, happened before them, happened at the DNC. If you think we have more time to keep beating around the bush, stay in the Democratic Party. If you don't, you know, move on. And move forward. And the more of us, the better. It's not that we can't collaborate in other ways. We can. But I've just seen the Democratic Party pull the rug out from under good things so often. Like, all the time. I mean, it never doesn't happen. It never does. They just don't let good stuff happen. They find a way to stop it. So, you know, I cannot comprehend why anyone would stay in the Democratic Party who's not brain dead. So, Bernie, the difference between Bernie and, like, our campaign was that we are not constrained by a counter-revolutionary party. That's the only difference. So we can actually take policies to their logical conclusion, like that we should be supporting Palestinian human rights and we should stop subsidizing Israeli militarism, things like that. And on climate change, you know, I think we need to work together. You know, to my mind, that is sort of the answer to how do we do anything. You know, how do we get the health care that we're not allowed to get? How do we get out of student debt? We got to do it together. We need a broad coalition for people, planet, and peace that adopts each of these goals, because the minute we come together, we are absolutely unstoppable for achieving each of these goals. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you talk about vaccinations, really?
Oh, sorry. Okay, yes. No, I do not want to listen. The thing about vaccinations is that the political power structure does not like you to challenge them on things like war, health care, immigrant rights, so they will make things up. It was like the birther issue of 2012. This was our birther issue that they made up. And it wasn't the only thing. I mean, they would keep coming up with these preposterous things, like that I said we should take down all Wi-Fi. No, I didn't say that. What I said was that the National Institutes of Health had just released a study suggesting that there could be some issues about exposing young children to a lot of Wi-Fi, and we ought to look into that. I mean, who in their right mind would say, forget about that, you know? Who cares about those kids? Let's find out, you know? And that's all I said was, like, the obvious no-brainer scientific thing is that if we have science, which is raising questions, we need to look at it. They also tried to say that I was a total backbencher when I was on the town meeting for my hometown in Lexington. And so I went and I dug out the records and the newspaper articles about how I had actually used my position in town meeting to challenge the effort to privatize what we called surplus lands in Massachusetts. And we had mounted a statewide coalition to stop the privatization of tens of thousands of acres. And so it's like, once they discover, oh, you weren't a backbencher, oh, well, then we're not going to cover it, you know? They just raise these issues in order to try to find an Achilles heel. So that's what they do. This isn't the last of it. You know, right now I'm a major public enemy because I'm a Putin operative, in case you didn't know. And I am, like, third parties are also Putin operatives. And we've taken our agenda from RT. You know, we didn't have our agenda for People, Planet, and Peace until I started to do a couple of appearances on RT. And this is in the National Security's consensus document. This is what our national security agencies are on record as saying, that I and the Green Party were accomplices to Putin in undermining the 2016 election. So we haven't heard the last. So are you? Okay, exactly. I mean, what is third-party politics? You know, this is a system that should be undermined by all people of conscience that are supporting democracy. So they will come up with that kind of nonsense, and we just have to stand up to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I'll leave it in there. I'm just not as tall as the previous person. Hello.
Hi.
Pretty awesome for you to be here today.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Sarah Torres, local musician and social justice activist.
Yes.
I was wondering your solution or solutions for the systemic problem, systemically produced problem of houselessness, especially when yes. local governments, for example, Humboldt County, Eureka, California, passing legislation such as anti-camping laws, mm-hmm. Anti-panhandling laws, mm-hmm. and supporting the police state or police forces to wake people up at early hours for not doing anything, not harming anyone, but sleeping in places where they're not doing anything, but maybe bothering people by them seeing them sleeping elsewhere and not in a home.
Yes.
And also, the other thing I was going to say was, if you haven't already said this somewhere else, if you were a vegetarian or vegan, that would be cool to know.
Okay, sure. So, yeah, there's absolutely no excuse to have houselessness now. We have more empty and abandoned houses than we do people who need them. So we need to reclaim those houses and put them into good use with people. We also need to provide low-cost housing, and we need to bring back public housing, which has been undermined and destroyed. We also need to stabilize housing through things like rent control and through community control of our housing. Right now, developers are in control of our communities and our housing, and it doesn't have to be that way. You know, this is all created by the system, so that can all be fixed. This is why we need to take you know, we need to take those positions of power. We need to throw the bums out that are currently occupying those positions of power and that have allowed this outrage to happen. So we should put an end to it. I am a mostly vegan, otherwise vegetarian person,
awesome.
Have been for most of my life.
That's cool. That was a question from Granny Vegan Seed. Just want to put that out there. So.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for your good words. I came in at the end of your... Were you talking up here? Yes. 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 I missed the song, but I did hear your words. I'd love to hear the song. Maybe I'll catch it. Great. Okay, afterwards. Let's do it. Yes. Thank you.
Cheese is very delicious. I know I have that problem, too. Mostly vegetarian. The vegan part's very hard. I'm working on it. Dr. Stein, I think we all kind of felt very disappointed after the Paris climate talks. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on that, and what are your thoughts on the global effort and global governance related to addressing climate change?
Great. Yes. So, the Paris climate talks were sort of a symbolic thing, and some people, you know, give them a lot of importance, but actually, you know, they will allow temperature to go up to what, some 3 or 4 degrees centigrade above baseline. You know, absolutely catastrophic. There's no enforcement mechanism. So, you know, and at the same time that those Paris agreements were being so celebrated, Congress and the White House were passing an end. They were repealing the fossil fuel export ban. So they were basically enabling a massive increase in fossil fuel production. So it really just exposed the incredible hypocrisy of the Democratic administration at that time. Some of us weren't so surprised. We need, you know, in terms of, like, where do we go from here in the global governance around that? Unfortunately, you know, the U.S. played a very destructive role in many of the climate summits. We were even spying on other countries so that we could undermine their climate proposals. It was absolutely devastating what we were doing. And if we were able to get our own house in order here, you know, I have no doubt that we could work with China, who's actually done some very positive things in terms of renewable energy and their commitment to turning things around. We could work with China. We ought to be working with Russia, who needs a lot of help because they have a totally fossil fuel economy and it's really dependent on fossil fuel production. You know, we should be acting as a responsible global citizen and encouraging the right thing to happen. I think it's not hard to persuade people that we've really got to do this. And if we didn't have such a powerful fossil fuel industry that was obstructing progress here, I think the whole world would start to move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ava from Climate Crisis Humboldt HSU. And thanks for coming.
Sure.
And I just want to answer how can we do individually to help fight climate change. The 350.org is new out here for Humboldt, and they have a table that you can sign up with.
That's great.
And then my question was, what would you say to a climate skeptic that says global warming is a hoax? Because I've been kind of arguing with the climate skeptic, and he's been referring to this 18-year pause or the global warming pause. And what I heard is that that's only for surface temperature, and that doesn't include ice in the ocean. So I wanted to hear what you had to say about the so-called pause in global warming.
Yeah, I mean, that's my impression too, is that it's sort of a distortion of the data to think that there was ever a pause. And you're going to see some natural variation, but what we're looking at right now, these major shifts in ecosystems, are not natural variation. You know, we are looking at the collapse of ecosystems. We're looking at the sixth great extinction right now, you know, that's predicting we may lose half of all species that are currently existing by the end of the century. As we go into a great extinction, it doesn't look good for human beings. You need to be the size of a squirrel if you want to survive a great extinction, because food supplies become short. So, you know, I personally don't spend a lot of time talking to people who don't get it yet. There's a saying from a famous author, it was Upton Sinclair, in fact, who was a socialist and also an activist, ran for governor in New York. He had a saying that you can't convince a man of something when his income depends on not knowing it. So there's some people, you're just not going to change their minds. And in the time that it would take you to change that person's mind, you could mobilize hundreds or thousands of people who are really ready to be there with you. And I would encourage you to, you know, to move on when you get stuck with that kind of person who loves to tie you up in knots and keep you from doing things that would really be effective with your time. And for me, the important argument to have up your sleeve is that climate and jobs go hand in hand, because that's where we lose most people. Most people are just really worried that how are they going to put their food on the table? So they're thinking, well, I got to do the fossil fuel thing. But even if you're doing the fossil fuel thing, you can be advocating. You can still be pushing for climate jobs and for the investments that we need. You know, we should have Green New Deals going on at the local level and the state level and so on. So I think, you know, that's really where people will start to shift when they hear that, wow, there's a whole jobs bonanza here waiting to happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Dr. Stein.
Hi.
I'm so excited to see you.
Likewise.
I just wanted to let you know that I boldly supported you and gave you my very first vote.
Thank you. Woo! All right.
So my name is Kristen Costanzo, and in 2010, my family fell victim to corporate violence enduring the San Bruno PG&E natural gas pipeline explosion. There, my childhood neighborhood was disintegrated in 5 seconds, and I lost 8 neighbors, as well as most of my innocence. And to this day, I still suffer from PTSD, as well as all my family. This has ignited a lot of anger in me, and I've been wanting to tackle this corporation head on. What is your advice towards starting that journey, especially as a young woman going up against an oligarchic monopoly like PG&E?
And where was this?
San Bruno, California, just about a mile south of San Francisco.
Okay. And when did it happen?
2010, September 9th.
Yeah. And what exactly blew up?
Right across the street from my childhood park was a natural gas pipeline that had not been maintained since 1946. Yeah. Yeah. There had been complaints about a smell of gas for mm-hmm. weeks beforehand mm-hmm. from the actual victims mm-hmm. of the explosion, the Bolson mm-hmm. family, mm-hmm. And they did nothing about it. And yeah. so corporate carelessness has affected both the mental health mm-hmm. and well-being of my family, I think, mm-hmm. for the rest of our lives.
Mm. Wow, how terrible. I'm so sorry. This is unfortunately way too common. With pipelines and then also just with natural gas provisions into homes, they leak and they explode. There was a home in my community that blew up. Fortunately, nobody was there at the time, but this is not unusual. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I think it's something like 500 people have been killed just from pipelines exploding over the last, I think it's 2 decades. And, you know, just incredible economic damage and injuries. And it's incredible that we live with this. It's absolutely outrageous. You know, I think it's very therapeutic. It's very healing to fight this stuff. And whether you're fighting specifically about that one incident or the whole generic hazard, it's extremely helpful. I myself, when I had my wake up, and my wake-up came in the area of just understanding the impact of toxic pollution on our health and how it has so, you know, made people sick just on a massive scale. I was, like, literally depressed about that until I started working with different groups to try to fight it and to get those dangerous substances off the shelf and off the market and then to constrain the corporations. You know, it's one step at a time, and you learn as you go, and it's going to take a powerful movement. The chemical industry and the natural gas industry is extremely powerful and extremely entrenched, and now that they're doing the fracking, you know, they're totally on the offensive. But they're on the offensive kind of hanging by the skin of their teeth right now because the market is collapsing out from under them.
They're under fire a lot.
They are totally under fire. They're a dangerous industry. They're trying to get a lot built right now because they know that they're only going to be able to do this for a few more years because renewables are undercutting them. So we're looking at really stranded assets that they're trying to build right now. So, you know, I would just encourage you to get involved, you know, if there's either on campus or a local struggle, to get involved with one of the groups and work your way up the pipeline from there. There's the potential for class action suits and things like that, but it takes a fair amount of organization and access to lawyers and things like that to do it. But you will learn just by getting involved with the whatever the prevailing fossil fuel struggle is. There are so many pipeline battles going on right now. It would be really great to have you involved as a part of that, because the more of us there are, the sooner we're going to get it done.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stein. You are an inspiration, I think, to women everywhere. So thank you. And people
so
everywhere.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is
Shante
Katt, and I am a 38-year-old student here at HSU. When I transferred here with my 2-year-old daughter and family, we became homeless for 13 weeks. This is a common issue in the CSU system and in colleges in general. My story has turned into advocacy, and right now we have 5 students, including myself, going to Sacramento to advocate for policies to change some of the practices that the CSUs are making.
Great.
Basically, HSU has 15% of our students who suffer homelessness throughout a semester. I'm wondering, at least for me, I spent $16,000 in those 13 weeks, and that was federal funding and student loans in order to keep my family safe. And I won't even go into the details. Do you have any suggestions? By the way, we're tabled out there. If anybody wants to help us, you can sign up, and we're looking for donations for our trip because we're funding it ourselves out of our pocket. Do you have any suggestions for us? 5 students are meeting with legislators and policymakers and senators this spring break.
Well, let me say that doing what you're doing is really important and is really powerful. And your story, you know, is so moving and so just unconscionable that this is happening, and that this is happening to 15%.
It's a little unethical as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
We're spending our federal funding. It's like this vacuum of economics.
It should, you know, and this is one of the reasons that I really encourage people to run for local office.
We have people that we're trying to get into seats.
Yes, great. And sometimes they can run for the boards of directors, for the colleges and the universities as well. And you can also run for positions on your city council, because then when you go and testify, you know, you really have weight then. You don't control the funding if you're on the city council, but your voice has a lot of weight. And I know that San Francisco, just in the last couple of weeks, established a free community college, 2 years.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. And that's what we all need to be doing. It should all be free. And I would not mince words, you know, when you go to talk to your elected officials about what it is that you deserve and what it is that students want. And if you can go with some kind of even a petition that shows that everybody supports this. It may be 15% who are homeless, but it's 100%, you know, who are just struggling to handle that debt.
Basically, at least from my situation, I'm paying interest to my student loans for being homeless. And that's just, I'm not the only student out there.
Yeah.
In 3 hours, I collected 130 students' stories. For
Incredible.
An ad that I put out. So,
yeah,
I mean, this is a
great.
Huge issue. And
it is. And it's especially outrageous because we know that public higher education pays for itself. For every dollar we put into it, as society, we get back $7 in return. Mm-hmm. So just tell them you're not going to stand for it. And people are running for office, and this is a high priority.
I appreciate that. Thank you for taking the time out for all of us here.
Thank you. My pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
Hi there.
Hi.
Wish I had more time to talk to you. I'll try to keep this quick. I voted for you. This is my first election I was able to vote in. And I voted for you because I realized that, as someone who supported Bernie especially, just watching what they did, I realized the Democrats had zero interest in ever serving any interests except for corporations. They have absolutely zero interest in serving those of the people. And I realized that very quickly. So I came to realize that third parties are probably the best solution. However, in America, especially with leftist political parties, they've been so relentlessly smeared over, I mean, for as long as they've existed that. I mean, the two-party system has essentially crushed third parties in public discourse. And I think that's especially true, like, for you as a third-party candidate, when you say something like about vaccines, if you don't, I mean, regardless of what your actual feelings are, if you don't say, you know, hey, I am 100% in favor of vaccinations, if you make a comment about Wi-Fi or something like that, all that's all that the media is going to run with, and that's all that the general public is going to think. And I guess my question really is just, how can we get third parties, especially leftist political parties in America, moving in a direction that kind of gains some steam, gains some real support in the public sphere? Because it really just, it has, unfortunately, has not happened as of yet.
Well, but remember how much energy they have to expend in order to keep it from happening. They have to control the dialogue. They have to censor it. I mean, in a sense, public opinion has already gone there. And while they may use very derogatory words, people basically agree. They actually agree that the FDA should not be run by the pharmaceutical companies, which was my point about vaccines, that they didn't like that, in fact, they should be approved by people who don't have a vested interest in making money off of them. That's how you make them safer. I think number one is to reject the propaganda that we're losing. We're not losing. You know, we're losing in a very corrupt and distorted system. But out there in the court of public opinion, this is what people think. You want to start, you know, we have to run at the national level because we can't give them a pass to just go to war endlessly and to assault the climate. We have to challenge them. But at the same time, then we got to work at the local level in order to get into office. And if you look at someone like Shama Sawant in Seattle, you know, how did she win? Not by mincing words, but by standing up for living wages, for rent control, for affordable housing, for doing the right thing. So it really comes down to being organized and to building strong teams to get behind candidates and create breakthrough elections. That's really where the breakthroughs will happen, and then you begin to build from there.
Thank you. It's really unfortunate because I think it is true that most Americans especially did support the platform of Bernie Sanders, and all of your main tenets of your platform, I think the American people would overwhelmingly agree with. However, it's just most people don't ever see that, you know. Most people are unaware of your platform, and it never breaks through, and it's such a problem. So
right, but think of it on the other hand, if we were organized at the local level, we would be able to get the word out. You know, and you can build on social media now. You know, you can also do door-to-door, which is what you have to do when you're running local races. So it's all about building an alternative infrastructure that kind of does an end run around the corporate-controlled infrastructure. We have to do that if we are going to prevail, we have to create an alternative means of communication. Right now, we've created this Facebook program called the Green News Network. I don't know if anybody knows of it out there. Yeah, all right. A few people do. So it's at Dr. Jill Stein. It grows out of our campaign, and we have a lot of awesome people on it, like Eric Ryberg right over there, who's done amazing work himself. And on the Green News Network, we lift up what these real solutions look like and also what real candidates look like. So it's all about building up those alternative tools.
Okay. Thank you, Jill.
So keep it up. Thank you.
Keep fighting.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Hi, thank you for coming here tonight.
Sure.
If you missed the beginning of Sara Torres's song, you may not know that you're in Wiat land, and the way it was occupied was very...
Okay.
I don't know the word for it, but they killed women and children on an island called Indian Island in their sleep with knives so locals would not hear. And I was told that after that, a cloud came over Eureka, and it's still there today. There's still issues there. And that was one of, I think, six different raids. It was basically a land grab over a period of years.
Is that so? Oh, God. Oh, how awful.
Oof. So essentially, we made the first people homeless, and we forced them to...
Yeah.
Find safety at... but I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about a contemporary issue. Sacred sites are really important to me, but I'm here to talk about homelessness, and I'm going to kind of piggyback on what people are already saying and then add my own concern. First, I'm going to do a shameless plug. One of our fearless leaders, Nezzy Wade, didn't come because you sold out. I don't know if you know that. A lot of people wanted to hear you. Which they had gotten the Van Dusen or something bigger. But we meet the first Saturday of the month at the Jefferson Project in Eureka, and the group is called the Affordable Homeless Housing Alternatives, or AHA, and we build tiny houses. We're looking for a place right now. Yeah. And we live in Eureka, and I got an interest in homelessness after, I've always been concerned about it, but after I graduated from college, I had huge student loans, and my job as like a substitute preschool teacher in the Bay Area, believe it or not, made it very hard to pay the bills.
Oh, yeah.
Moving up here when I became a mother, I also became homeless when I decided I wanted to be a single mom. And then recently I became homeless again. I was very fortunate. There was a program we were able to enter the first time, which the second time we didn't qualify for. But I had really good friends. But, you know, where we live now, you can see the homeless people camping out on the bay getting harassed by the police. And we're working very hard to change things. Marco, please stop. But there's a stigma about homelessness, the tweakers, and they somehow deserve it. We all have our addictions, and I'm sure their life is hard enough without the hatred going on. But I was wondering, I feel like it's easier for certain politicians, and I'm not talking about Arcata. I really appreciate, I don't know if any of the council people are here today, but they actually invited someone to speak about building tiny houses because they wanted to look into it. Cool. But other city council people have tried to kind of brush the issue under the rug and kind of just hope if we keep doing things to encourage them to leave, maybe they'll just go away. But we actually have one of the highest rates of homelessness per capita in the entire state. So it's an emergency, but people aren't treating it like one. And I was wondering, how do we gain momentum for a movement? How do we wake people up? Because we have enough money in this county to house everybody. And if we house everyone, we would save money. It's like, it doesn't make sense to me why we don't. And I just would like to hear your advice because you obviously, you know, are doing great things and people know your name. So...
Thank you, and thank you for your work, and thanks for the tiny houses for doing work on that. That's a really important tool, and thanks for raising that tonight because I think it is something, you know, it's really hopeful and
they're sustainable.
Yes, well, that's so cool. Great,
off the grid even.
Do you have something about it out there?
I can get you something.
Yeah, that'd be great. Or give me a website.
We have a website.
Or something. I'd love to know more about it. Yeah, do you want to say what it is so everybody can hear it?
I don't know it memorized, but if you Google, we have a Facebook, Google AHA and Humboldt and see what you get.
Jefferson Project.
What is it?
Jefferson Project? You can find a link to it at the Jefferson Project.
Okay. All right, great. You know, I think... coalitions are the name of the game, and homelessness is it's a huge problem, and goes hand in hand with gentrification, and it's just part of this, you know, horrible insecurity that is just become a way of life, and it's intolerable. So it makes all the sense in the world to build this into a basic agenda, you know, and run people on that agenda. You know, so that taking care of homelessness and building affordable tiny homes or whatever the solutions are, that gets built into another platform, which is about sanctuary cities, which is about addressing student debt. You know, you have a 5-point platform, and then you run for office, and you get, you know, all these people who are afflicted by it. You make sure that they're registered to vote so that they can vote.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just that kind of turning the crank for organizing around really popular issues, issues that get traction, issues that really impact large numbers of people. And this impacts way more people than the numbers who are homeless, because everybody's worried about becoming homeless. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you should be able to get a lot of support on this and just build it in as a basic piece of a platform. And then, you know, and then just start running. And, you know, you can work with a local Green Party chapter to develop an agenda.
Okay.
And, you know, I would think they would be very receptive to that.
All right, one more shameless plug. I don't represent the county, but I work part-time for the county, and our union, AFSCME, has free associate's degree. So you can look into that if you have a parent that works for AFSCME. It's there for the people that work for them and their children.
Great. Oh, that's great. Terrific. Thanks for that. Thank you. And just in view of the time, I'm going to try to do more like a lightning round here to just be sure we can get through all the questions. So if you can try to confine your remarks to about a minute, and I'll try to keep my response to a minute, and then we should be able to make it.
Hi, Jill. Big fan. Going to keep
Thank
it
you.
Short. Today's the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and in that light, my question is, with the gross obviousness of economic inequality and climate destruction, is it important to convince people to see red when they can just vote green?
Say that again. Is it important?
Is it important to convince people to read Lenin and see red in a sense?
As they vote green?
Yeah.
That's a really good point. I mean, I think there's no doubt that we need a profound system change, and that the crisis that we face has everything to do with this predatory capitalism that is destroying all aspects of our lives. And yeah, I think the Green Party is not just about trees and ecosystems, although that stuff is really important, but you're not going to fix it if that's the only thing that you're working on. Because then it'll be part of the same old divided and conquered. We need a broad agenda for justice, and you don't get to that unless you're also seeing the red in the green.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name's John Veit. I'm a sociology student here.
Hi, John.
My mom and brother and niece all live in Lexington, Massachusetts, so thanks for coming down. We appreciate you coming all this way. Basically, let's get this thing cooking. I wanted you to hopefully clarify your Syria position. You've said that the people who got attacked in 2013 with chemical weapons, you deem that as a false flag. And could you explain more this whole Russia RT thing? And I think a lot of people are really disappointed at you dodging the vaccine question.
So the false flag was a statement made by Ajamu, not by me. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But what about that as a party? Like, you haven't distanced yourself from it? Have you explain a little more?
Okay.
You're getting a lot of heat from it, and I have a hard time explaining.
Yeah, well, position. There's a lot of heat being generated around that.
From people that otherwise would dig your whole platform. I'm like...
Yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of unanswered questions here. There is a lot of controversy around, you know, who actually was responsible for that chemical weapons attack, and there's evidence to show that the chemical fingerprint of the gas that was used is different from that belongs to the Syrian army. So that's why there's question about attributing it to Syria. I don't know myself. I really don't know. And I don't have an opinion about it because I haven't heard definitive evidence one way or the other. And in terms of what to do about Syria, you know, I don't think that's a black and white thing either. You know, there's no doubt that that Assad, you know, has been committed horrible human rights violations. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's not like that a regime change solves things either. There was a time, I think it was 2012, when Russia was trying to intervene and work with a peace coalition that included moving Assad out. The U.S. wasn't interested at that point, and now we're just at loggerheads with Russia, which is not a good thing. So, you know, I'll just say that I think there's fault to go around here on both sides. You could talk about Ukraine as well. The U.S. had a role in the coup in Ukraine. Some people will say that there was a vote in the Crimea that voted for secession and that voted for allying with Russia. So there's evidence all over the place here. You know, and then there's Victoria Nuland, who was shown on, you know, the assistant U.S. Secretary of State, who was shown to be planning who would come in after the Ukrainian coup. And go back further than that, you had the U.S. promising Gorbachev that we were not going to move missiles 1 inch to the east of Berlin after the reunification of Germany. And now we've surrounded Russia with missiles. So Russia is a bit on the defensive right now. It's like the Cuban Missile Crisis on steroids. So I think beating war drums is not a useful position right now. You know, I think there needs to be a peace process. We need to get the weapons industry out of pushing for war and trying to demonize Russia in the same way they're trying to demonize China, because we need a big enemy. If we're going to prop up big military budgets, we need a big enemy. So, you know, I think we need level heads, and we need to actually look at the facts and not just try to say that there are good guys in white hats and bad guys in black hats. It just doesn't work that way.
Thanks.
Thank you. I think we already talked about the vaccination thing. Okay.
Talk to me about my forced shingles. They will. Don't dare.
Can we let him ask his question?
Yeah.
So
next, go ahead.
So I have two quick questions. One, as you kind of mentioned about the sanctuary city, the city is in the process of becoming that through the leadership of Centro del Pueblo and Dave Meserve. And so there are some council members here, see Paul over here. I'd just like to plug in and say, why is it important for everyone here to show up on March 22nd and April 5th to push this bill or ordinance through the city council for declaring this? Because the CSU has stopped short of doing it, so we need to create a buffer for the round. And then the second question is, if your party has a stance on the five U.S. colonies that the U.S. owns as mere property through the Instar cases, because if we truly care to dismantle this American empire, we have to rid it of its colonial resources. And little point, what O'Connor said about seeing the red to the green, one of the big reasons why I think we will always continue to be divided is we would not be able to take down the capitalist system without seizing the means of production. That's something that Bernie Sanders himself has shied away from, and I think other people. There is no way we're just going to do pretty much a regime change if we continue with what's going on. So just those first two, that was just added.
Great. Thank you. So which questions did you want me to respond to?
Just the sanctuary city, why people should show up on April 5th, and then if your party has a stance on the colonies.
Great. Okay. So, people should definitely show up, because that's how you get stuff done. You know, you need to run for office, but then you also need to get out and support the office holders who are going to promote your positions. You really need to be there. Democracy is not a spectator sport, absolutely. And on colonialism, yeah. I mean, I think we need to put our money where our mouth is, and if we believe in democracy, then it needs to be democracy for everybody, not just for some. And there should be complete right of self-determination for those... you know, for those nations that were basically occupied and invaded by the U.S., okay. Without a doubt. Thank you. Yes. And Puerto Rico should be bailed out for starters. Yeah. Hi.
Thank you so much for making the effort to show up here and share your words with us. So I'm going to assume everybody here understands what the petrodollar recycling is. You've mentioned throughout your speech tonight I'm going to maybe change the words up a little bit, but decarbonizing the economy, mm-hmm. transitioning toward a mm-hmm. Green economy. There's an inherent sort of catch-22 in that, which is that... when Nixon transitioned from the gold standard to floating the dollar, we now have something called petrodollar recycling, which we have a perpetual inflation, and in order to import oil, it's denominated in dollars, and we have an inherent interest in doing that and in protecting the U.S. dollar denomination. At the same time, we've also racked up about $20 trillion in debt, and by about mid-century, we're going to be paying out more in interest than we are in anything that Congress decides to do with our money. So any thoughts about how to, avoid a total catastrophe and maybe transition the economy? Do we have to change our currency to something else, or how's this going to work?
Yeah, I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but clearly, because the dollar is linked to oil, yeah. I mean, we're going to have to change our currency. So I can't really offer a whole lot more at this point, but that's a very good point. And I'd be interested to hear if there are people who are talking about what needs to be done there, because clearly something's going to need to be done.
The Green Party actually has a position. I'm David Cobb as the Green Party nominee in 2004 and managed Jill's campaign. We actually have a policy. Go to greeningthedollar.org if you're interested. It is a transformational, revolutionary monetary policy. It's part of our formal platform. And to the last gentleman, I can actually say the Green Party has also formally adopted an eco-socialist position in a very formal democratic way. So the Green Party actually is in the process of a red-green alliance, and greeningthedollar.org would answer that question.
Thank you.
And I want to just give a big shout out for David Cobb, who was our presidential candidate in 2004 and is now one of the organizers of the Green Party here in Arcata. So you know where to find him.
Hey, Jill. Hey. Thanks for coming. My name's Amma.
Hi, Amma.
I just wanted to start off by just mentioning that that the Kurdish revolutionary fighters of northern Syria are extending their solidarity to everyone on this International Women's Day. Whoa. They're calling on people to join in their feminist struggle to overthrow patriarchy, capitalism, Daesh terrorism, and to build a new social democracy in Rojava, which is Western Kurdistan. So just wanted to give a shout out to them. And yeah, that's right. just as a side note. Okay, and then my actual question has to do with the Matol Forest, which is a campaign that has been focused on for years by the forest defense community here. It's some of the last remaining old-growth, lowland, coastal Douglas fir forest in the world, essentially. It's the home to rare animals and species like the agaricon mushroom, which has shown promise against cancer, avian flu, tuberculosis, and possibly even Ebola. And essentially, we've been engaged in direct action struggle kind of, you know, in boom and bust cycles. And we're acknowledging the importance of this area for climate change. It buffers the fog that's coming in and hitting the old growth redwood forest that we all know and love. And I guess I'm just wondering, how do we make that? We're facing imminent threat to some of that area this summer. So how do we bridge that gap between... They're about to cut these trees down, and the global community out there that understands the importance of protecting our old-growth forest for the climate.
Yeah, that's a really huge and compelling issue. And, you know, sometimes people do really dramatic... you know, PR things, tree sitting, or, you know, just kinds of civil disobedience that really gets the eyes of the world on you. That's really important. I mean, you know, and you make such a good point, because forests are getting lost in the shuffle right now. You know, there's not much attention being given to the plight of forests. And they need, you know, we need to be mobilizing to protect them, just like with stopping pipelines. And one thing I can offer you is just that we could help lift it up on the Green News Network, you know, and just help get it out there and let people hear about what you're doing, and maybe we can exchange information afterwards, because it's all about just getting people to stand up and take action. And, you know, is it at the federal level? Is it at the state level? Where is this... Taken place.
It's in private hands. It's owned by Humboldt Redwood Company, which is the successor to Maxam, which created a lot of the environmental devastation that eventually crushed the timber industry in this area.
I see. Yeah, so that makes it really hard to get at if it's private. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more.
Yeah. Let's brainstorm around it, and you know, and we can do a Facebook live interview around it too, and just try to get the word out. Great, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so we're getting the word. We have to really move into lightning round now.
I waited.
I guess we got about like less than a minute for a question.
Hi, Jill.
Hi.
I crafted my question on this CIA-sponsored phone. And then also, can you indulge me in a selfie later?
Definitely,
I'm a collector.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
I find myself in a minority amongst my friends and family because my degree is in an arguably pro-capitalist field, accounting. Even more damning is my license as an enrolled agent granted by the IRS. Hearing your comment about 54% of our income taxes going towards our bloated military made my stomach turn a little bit, because I'm actually helping people file their taxes. I can Google my ethical dilemma till the cows come home, but I figured I should take this opportunity to ask a brilliant mind such as yourself for guidance in handling this issue while maintaining my integrity. Mm. What advice would you give to me and other people like me working in the accounting, finance, and banking industries with regards to remaining ethical in the revolution for people, planet, and peace?
Really great, great question. And let me just clarify, it's 54% of the budget, of the discretionary budget, but it's more like 44% of your income taxes. So, yeah, I'm right. It's still pretty outrageous. You know, I think, first of all, there are very few pure jobs out there. And all of us who pay income taxes, you know, whether we have help or not, you know, are contributing to this moral outrage. And if you convert that moral outrage into fuel for fighting for justice, then, you know, then I think that's kind of what we have to do, because it's very hard to be completely pure and still have a role to play in society. There's a candidate right now, a green candidate who's running for Congress in L.A., Kenneth Mejia, who was also... Do you know Kenneth?
So he...
Oh, is that so? Well, he too is an accountant. And he was a very successful accountant, and working for some very big accounting firms. And he got very turned on to politics by Bernie. And now, after Bernie went for Hillary, he got green. And, you know, accountants have very good skills that we need in the green world, too. So, you know, consider it, you know, you got your day job, but then, you know, what you do with the rest of your time is yours. And I would encourage people, you know, to do the best that you can, but, you know, there are a lot of taxpayers in this country who need help paying their taxes. So there you're doing a good. Unfortunately, we need the IRS. We do need the IRS. And what we don't need is the war part of it. But we can fight the war part of it and, you know, and keep the IRS and make it a more just institution. So let's do that.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
Hey, Jill Stein. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you.
I'll make it fast. I wanted to know if you are going to begin campaigning for 2020, and if so, how you're going to start doing that.
Great. So I basically consider myself in the fight, whether that fight is an electoral fight or whether it's a political organizing fight or whether it's a fight for the social movements. I change hats all the time and have been doing that for about 16, 18 years. So it feels very organic to me, whether this is a running for office or whether this is just helping to build political power. It all amounts to kind of the same thing in my mind. And I, you know, I don't have a position about 2020. You know, it's like, let's see what happens then, and are there other green candidates that are strong that can do this? Are there other roles that I can play? I don't really care what I do. I'm not a professional politician, and I don't have a stake in running political campaigns. I have a stake in creating a world that my kids can survive in, and if all kids can't survive in it, my kids can't survive in it. So that's kind of my opinion about that, is that, like, the actual decision is really secondary. The main thing is that we all just keep fighting as hard and fast as we can.
Thank you. And thank you for doing what you do seemingly tirelessly.
What's that?
Thank you for doing what you do seemingly tirelessly.
And, thank you.
You're very intelligent.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, I'm really short. I'm a member of something, an initiative that exists here in California called, it's okay, thanks, called the Keeping Kids in School and Out of Court Initiative. I'm a member of that steering committee. And it's brought to my attention issues of school push-out and the school-to-prison pipeline and how that affects students in California and everywhere in the U.S. I often hear your position on free college compared to European systems, where they tend to screen students kind of that are college and non-college bound out really early, which presents a problem somewhere like America, where racism, classism, and ableism are already blatantly institutionalized in the school system. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you managed or how you plan to implement free college without exacerbating that, but also taking it a step further and trying to dismantle that.
Great. Okay, really good question. And I think the point is not to push for college. And often it gets abbreviated as college, but it's basically post-secondary education is essentially what the real deal here. You want to encourage post-secondary education because that's what people need if they're going to have employment. And so that way it doesn't really, you know, matter. It's like everybody gets a boost. And you know, I think people who want to go to college, they get to try to go to college. And people who don't, and they want to do a manual skill or something that doesn't involve 4 years of college, they can go to a two-year post-secondary school and get the support to do what they want to do. But I think it's our job to provide a menu of options to young people and to let them figure it out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. I'm Francesca.
And let me just, the final thing in answer to that question is that we have plenty of money if we stop spending it on the military. Exactly. The amount of money it takes to educate people is actually really tiny. Tiny compared to the military. We should not... Yes, build housing. I mean, we can meet all of our needs if we do a major, you know, house cleaning on the military. Yeah. Thank you.
So I'll try to talk fast so I can get through this.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm a graduate student in the Environment and Community Program. I'm doing my graduate project on the crisis of affordable housing in the built environment in relation to the Latino and Hispanic community through the case study of the Mission District. I have a background in interior architecture and design and community organizing on environmental and sociopolitical strategy teams in back in the city.
Yeah.
So... this summer I'll be interning for the Mission Economic Development Agency on the architecture creative design team and as an organizer. So I'm really excited.
Cool.
And you've really inspired me as an activist and
thank you.
An organizer. So I have two quick questions and you can answer them briefly. From your perspective, what has the lack of equitable housing done to communities across the country, specifically communities of color? Mm-hmm. And do you think gentrification plays a significant role in modern-day genocide?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In short. The impact of inequitable housing is huge, and it's part and parcel of this resegregation that society has undergone. We're now more segregated, you know, than we've been in decades. And then that is then used to inequitably fund schools. You know, it connects to everything. And we know that people who lose housing are very much at risk for all sorts of violence and poor health and death. And this is very serious and dangerous stuff, and it shouldn't be treated casually. And it is a manufactured problem. You know, it is a consequence of using housing as an opportunity to profiteer instead of providing a basic human right. And yes, gentrification is totally connected to this, because gentrification is the process of profiteering out of housing and buying up low-quality housing and rehabbing it and then, you know, making a killing off of it. And meanwhile, you've decimated a community. And those community bonds are critical. That's what makes life, you know, meaningful for people, is being connected in our communities. So all this is absolutely critical, and it sounds like you have the perfect job over the summer. So yes, congratulations with that.
Thank you so much. And may I get a selfie after?
Yes, okay. Definitely. Great, thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Stein, thank you so much for all the integrity that you modeled for the citizens of our nation, this fierce love that was so obvious, and we thirsted for every bit of coverage we could find this whole process through, and I just want to thank you for that. And the vaccination thing, I know that you have explained it over and over and over, and it's just so annoying. It still comes up for people, so I wanted to make sure no one thought, she's dodging it again, and it just keeps repeating itself. So that was that. So many questions, but let me just touch on something that's personal for me as a healing arts therapist in this area for a long time. And also having direct experiential knowledge of mental health crisis in my own family and seeing it in so many families that I've worked with through the years. The housing crisis, you know, it's really gone, it seems to have gone beyond, you know, give people houses and jobs and they're going to be fine and functional. We really have this epidemic issue here, and our numbers are off the chart here in Humboldt. Our mental health crisis is quite a feat. quite challenging. And so your thoughts on community wellness centers that really are a one-stop shop for people to be able to get an array of energy mm-hmm. medicine that is mm-hmm. unaffordable to everyone right now. Unless you have big bucks, you cannot access these amazing modalities of healing that can mm-hmm. really help people decompress from mm-hmm. childhood trauma that's stifling them. It's not just mm-hmm. the fact that they've been impoverished. I mean, there's been mental health crisis in this country forever, but now to be impoverished on top of those mm-hmm. challenges mm-hmm. that now become full-blown psychosis, and the streets are dangerous now. My daughter had a gun pulled on her at a park walking her dog.
Oh, my God.
That happens anywhere in big cities, but this is like little country town, Humboldt County, and it's becoming more and more violent. So just your thoughts on being able to, in the future, see more funding for community-based wellness centers where mm-hmm. anybody and everyone as mm-hmm. a right, if they are willing, yes. if they're a willing receiver yes. Yes. to get services, can right. get rehabilitated, restored into yes. a higher state of functioning so they can go back to work. Because
yes.
housing and jobs isn't really going to cut it if you have people just squatting in tiny houses that are so afflicted. Mm-hmm. And so many people that mm-hmm. I love and honor mm-hmm. that I've worked with, mm-hmm. they're in this cycle of addiction, right. of yes. mental health afflictions.
Yes. Beautiful. I mean, I think you've kind of made the case for it right there. And I'll just add that, you know, there is this epidemic of mental health dysfunction that permeates our society. Mm-hmm. And it's so related to the way that we have poisoned our basic institutions. We've poisoned our food, our air, our water.
Yes.
These things are so connected.
Absolutely.
When people are lead poisoned or pesticide poisoned, one of the first things that they lose is the ability to, interact
yes.
respectfully and lovingly and to read social cues and things like that.
Sure.
And it's like an indicator of how sick we are that mentally, we have really fallen apart. And so you have to fix it on all levels.
Right.
You know, we have to attend to our nutrition and to our health care and to...
You have to have the tools to know how to do that.
Yes,
you know.
And all these things all go together. But mental health can't be left out, and right now it keeps being left out. And it needs to be a basic part of healthcare, but as you say, it should be more integrated in an organic way with just our social lives. So that it's not medicalized and kind of made scary. And it ought to be integrated with the arts. You know, mental health is on a continuum
exactly.
with just sort of community health.
Yes, restorative services.
Right.
The whole vessel, the whole vahana, vahana restoration,
yes.
all the way to restore the body, the mind, the spirit.
And, restoration, you know, and also just, I think, honoring community and celebrating community.
Yes.
That if you're building in... community arts and music and dance and visual arts and poetry, you know, it's therapeutic for everybody. It's also preventive for everybody.
Exactly. It's and violence prevention funding
totally.
Switched back to
yes.
art and music that was cut.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. It pays for itself.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
I just really wanted to thank you for getting on all the state ballots that you achieved. Was that 48?
Yeah, I think it was 48. That's right. Yes. I got to thank all the volunteers that got out there and made that happen. Yeah, it's incredible.
Was that the first time a third party got on that many ballots in the nation?
Well, I'll tell you, the Libertarians are able to buy their way on. So they do that. In fact, I think they were on 49, I believe.
Okay.
We're definitely getting better at this.
I just can't thank you enough for doing that. I'm sure it was a lot of work. And do you know how likely it is the Green Party will be able to do that again for 2020?
We are so much bigger now than we were in 2016 when we were fighting to get on the ballot. I think that we are definitely going to be on the ballot. In fact, if we get enough registrations into the Green Party, if everybody in this room got 10 people to register green, and, you know, and it's not like you need to go to the other end of the earth. You know, it's just by getting people like you who share the same struggle around housing, around around, you know, fighting deportations, around clean air. Just getting more people like you fighting student debt, you know. That's how we get to critical mass. And then we're on the ballot without having to do... Once you get the registrations, if you maintain those registrations, you don't have to do ballot drives. So it's a permanent way onto the ballot.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Humboldt.
Thank you. Keep up the good work. Thanks for being here.
Hi, I'm John Macklin, and I'm a local resident here for many, many years. Wear many hats. lifetime member in the Environmental Center, and then Veterans for Peace.
Oh, great.
We like to stand up with the women's rights, and so we do a lot of
thank you.
Traffic.
Great work. Things.
What I have for you today is this shirt. I don't know if you noticed it.
Ha, 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 1994. Wow.
Back
incredible.
In the beginning, when we first came out there, and I know a lot of guys that are here. Anyway, this shirt was one of four. And they thought it was too much of an excitement for drawing attention. And they felt that they needed to go to something that was nice, not quite as dramatic. But I think we're in a time now where we can do this.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And
that's great.
I really feel it because tonight I watched the Rachel Maddow show. I don't know if you're familiar with this woman talking about women's rights and things like this. She's on the MSNBC, you know, programs. Tonight, she sewed it up. She's been working on the Russia connection. And it turns out that these guys, so many of them, are actually, have actually done the same. They have actually become traitors in their own country. And that's what's, you know, going to be coming out tomorrow. You're going to see it 9 o'clock tonight. Right now, she begins the next series of this. I'm putting that out for you. The other thing, too, is Before the Flood. I don't know if you know anything about the DiCaprio movie that's coming out from UN on environment. Yeah. It's the update. Hmm. It's incredible. We have it here. John Schaefer has it from the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We've been putting it out for different places for people to see this. It's 90 minutes, and it's dynamite. It'll change your ways, and hopefully another people. And I'd like to ask you this question. With this information going down here, not only all of us need to be pulling together to be able to do, and it's not just Bernie, it's not just Hillary, it's us as a people. Our group here, Green, ought to be doing, working together with this on this issue to go ahead and enforce. What do you do with somebody that's outright given away his cabinet to Russia? I mean, this is incredible. It's never happened before in our history. And that's why I want to wake you up to it. And so we should be really ready to go here. And I'm going to give you this card because it has that. And I'm willing to give
you
the shirt if you would like it. The shirt on my back. It's in perfectly good shape. If somebody wants to have this for their shirt, auction it off.
It's beautiful.
I'm getting ready for another big world. I'm old enough, and you are too.
So cool. Anyway, all right. Well, thank you. And I'll just say, there are several dimensions, you know, to the Russia connection. And the one that I think is most worrisome is the financial connections that Donald Trump appears to have with the Russian oligarchs who apparently funded him when he couldn't borrow millions of dollars for his investments. He apparently got that from the Russian oligarchs. And that's true for several members of his cabinet. We know that Rex Tillerson has a $500 billion deal with the Russians that he's trying to nail down so he can get access to their to their oil. So there are a lot of very shady business interests, and these are connections to like the Russian mafia and the Russian mob, which are very worrisome, and Donald Trump needs to release his tax returns so we know exactly who his business interests are with. But that said, the other stuff about, you know, the hacking into the DNC, I think we don't know the story there. What we know is that the Democrats really wanted to distract from what was in those emails, and they started pointing to the Russians, but we haven't seen really compelling data.
You'll see it tonight if you go. Just catch
it. Yeah. Well, we haven't seen concrete stuff yet, but, you know, who knows? Maybe something will come out. It might be that the CIA was doing it and not the Russians, for all we know. Let's find out. I think it's just really important to beware of the new McCarthyism, beware of the new Cold War with Russia, and the role of the weapons industry, which wants to have a big enemy in order to boost their military budgets. So let's just be thinking people. Let's not be goaded by a corporate media that wants to beat the war drums here. Let's wait and see what the evidence is, because they've been claiming that it was Russia. But, you know, they wrote a report. I don't know if anybody saw the consensus report of the intelligence agencies. It talks about the proof of the Russians, but the only proof it has are these very nonspecific IDs that are not, they're not specific. And today we learned from WikiLeaks that the CIA knows how to leave somebody else's fingerprints on the stuff. So this has not been proven that it's the Russians. That same document that said that we have all this evidence on the Russians also said they have all this evidence on third parties and that we are in collusion with Putin. And I can tell you that we are not in collusion with Putin. Even though I went as part of a peace delegation to a conference with RT at their 10-year anniversary, along with Ray McGovern, who you may know of in Veterans for Peace. He was there along with me, along with Lee Camp, who some of you may know, Lee Camp. He was there. Rocky Anderson. He's there, too. Mikhail Gorbachev was actually there at this same dinner as well. And let's see. Oh, Jesse Ventura was there, too. So are we all agents of Putin? I don't think so. And the same intelligence agency report says that the Green Party was in collusion with Putin in order to undermine Hillary Clinton in the campaign. I don't believe that. That is just patently false. So if they got something as basic as that wrong, I'm not sure that the other half of their report is exactly valid and stands up to scrutiny either. So I want to see what they come out with. I'm waiting to see the data to be persuaded. Russia could have done it. They sure could have, because this is routine. This is what modern-day countries do to each other, is hack and use that information. And, in fact, we bought the election in Russia that elected Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin. We bought that election. So this is a two-way street, and it's all really reprehensible and should be stopped. This isn't to say it's okay, but just that this is not something to go to war about, and it's also not something to create a Cold War or a new McCarthyism about. So we got to be careful, because there are a whole lot of issues that are being thrown together for political purposes right now. So we need to be careful. Yeah, thank you.
Yes. So. Sorry, I know we're out of time. I'm tired, you're tired, we're all tired. Yeah. I won't take too long with this. But basically, I wanted to ask one other question, not really related to Russia, but recent issue that's probably going to become more recent because of Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee of death with dignity laws. His nominee, Neil Gorsuch, I don't know how you say it, but anyways, yes. he's written extensively on the subject as opposed to it. Some states have recently begun expanding on allowing patients to have those sorts of options to consult with their doctors.
Yes.
I was just wondering what would the Green Party or you or whichever actually do in these sorts of situations, or how would they rule from here?
Yeah, David, do you know, does the Green Party have a position on this? I would think so. Yes. So Green Party supports it. You know, personally, I support it too. This is a, you know, it's a respect we show to our animals, to our pets, to save them, you know, the pain and suffering when they're, you know, heading for an inevitable end. So, you know, why do we not accord this benefit to people? I think it's very important we not let this get corporatized, we not let this become a profiteering industry. That's a valid concern. But concern for that should not make us condemn people to agonizing and prolonged, needless suffering in the course of dying.
Thank you so much again for coming here.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So I think... one more question. You get to wrap us up for tonight.
I actually don't have a question. I came up here to wrap us up for
all
tonight.
All right.
So my name is Tay Triggs. I'm the Associate Dean for Student Engagement Leadership
Woo-hoo.
Here at HSU.
All right.
And on behalf of HSU Greens and Climate Crisis student leaders and members, as well as the other departments that work to make this event happen, like the Clubs and Activities Office, AS Presents, Center Arts, right. Our Risk Management Office, they all came together to make sure that your visit was great, as well as Arcata. And we thank you for even including us.
Oh, man.
But we'd like to thank you. Thank everyone for the questions you asked. Thank you all for sticking around. Look at you.
Yeah, amazing.
But I'm thirsty and I'm hungry, so I'd say let's all make it a night.
Let's do that.
And so thank you all again for coming. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You guys totally rock. Go HSU. Thank you so much. So beautiful. Yeah. I love it. It's gorgeous. Thank you so much.